Indonesia at the fulcrum, the maritime fulcrum of the Indo-Pacific area, is critical.
Indonesia and the United States find common strategy goals. It's Wednesday, January 24th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. We're on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, new tariffs impact South Korea and China. Myanmar not deemed safe for Rohingya return. VOA business scene, real life Star Trek, and new tech for you. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis sought to improve security ties with Indonesia as he met with President Joko Widodo and other officials on a two-nation Asian trip that will also take him to Vietnam. Both countries are discussing maritime defense and counterterrorism cooperation. Indonesia has sparred with China over fishing rights around the Natuna Islands, at one point detaining Chinese fishermen. In July, Jakarta renamed the northern reaches of its exclusive economic zone as the North Natuna Sea. Mattis spoke with reporters after meeting his Indonesian counterpart.
And certainly Indonesia at the fulcrum, the maritime fulcrum of the Indo-Pacific area, is critical. And as we can help in maintaining the maritime domain awareness in the South China Sea, the North Natuna Sea, this is something that we look forward to doing. We think we must work together. We are out to expand in ways that respond to any requests from Indonesia on counterterrorism, to include the special forces units that conduct counterterrorism, because in protecting the innocent people, which Indonesia, by the way, has done a very good job on over this last 10 years, we know that we can learn a lot from them, and we must work together on this larger problem.
Mattis said this is a strategic partnership and said the United States is deeply committed to the Indo-Pacific region and building on a long history of close cooperation on economic, diplomatic, and security issues. Kevin Evans is a Jakarta-based Australian independent analyst. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the strategic partnership historically has never been robust.
There's a long history in Indonesia of non-alignment, which goes back to the very early days. The last government that tried to establish a military arrangement with another country was an Islamist government in 1951 that tried to form a relationship and alliance with America, and that government was soon toppled and no one's ever tried to raise the issue again. So the nature of Indonesian collaboration on defence matters is not in the kind of alliance format that we might often find with, say, places like Western Europe, Australia, or Japan.
Indonesia is a critical potential ally in the Southeast Asia region when it comes to Chinese sovereignty rights in the South China Sea.
There's a bigger issue, of course, for Indonesia. There's certainly that. And I think a lot of people here were a little uncomfortable about what appeared to be unilateral redefining of boundaries that actually brought into Indonesian territorial waters. So Indonesia's traditional role of trying to be a good officers broker between Indonesia and other Southeast Asian states was put on hold when it sort of ended itself up becoming part of the disputed territories. For Indonesia also, there's the notion of unity of the Southeast Asian nation. That's actually something else where China's increasing influence in the region, not just militarily, but quite broadly, has actually made it more difficult to retain the unity of ASEAN. And I think for Indonesia and a number of countries within ASEAN, that notion of unity among the 10 members is quite profound to their sense of security, and an incapacity for that to be undermined, I think, gives all a sense of insecurity.
Kevin, what can you tell me about the Natuna Islands, apparently claimed by Indonesia, and some Chinese fishermen were detained there?
It's always been part of the Republic of Indonesia. It's at the northern end of Indonesia in the province of Riau Archipelago. What probably makes it of interest to a number of people is that there's significant underwater gas reserves there.
This trip by Mattis involves both Indonesia and Vietnam. What does that tell you about what U.S. policy might be forming vis-a-vis China?
The choice of Indonesia and Vietnam are very interesting. It's perhaps reflects that the relationship between the U.S. and the Philippines isn't as comfortable and close as it's been for many decades. And clearly Vietnam has a complicated relationship with China and has also had a much improved relationship with the United States over the last couple of decades, and I would have thought any wise administration in the US would seek to make as much as they can from that opportunity.
Indonesia's defense minister Tuesday expressed hope Mattis would try to remove sanctions placed on Indonesia's special forces in the wake of human rights violations committed in the 1990s. He hopes the special forces unit would soon be allowed to train in the United States. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Pentagon eyes expanded counter-terror cooperation in Indonesia. CIA chief says North Korea's nuclear program aims to defend and intimidate. The United Nations says Myanmar is not safe for Rohingya refugees to return. Myanmar court to rule next week on fate of detained Reuters journalists. China and South Korea protest U.S. tariffs on washing machines and solar panels. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, and you can also stop by the VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. South Korea and China criticized a decision Monday by President Donald Trump to impose stiff tariffs on imports of washing machines and solar panels. The action followed a conclusion by the U.S. International Trade Commission that found the imported products were a substantial cause of serious injury to domestic manufacturers. The U.S. plans to impose a 20% tariff on the first 1.2 million imported large residential washers in the first year, 50% tariffs on additional imports, and declined to 16 and 40 respectively in the third year. A 30% tariff will be slapped on imported solar cells and modules the first year, dropping to 15% by the fourth year. 2.5 gigawatts of unassembled solar cells will be imported each year, tariff-free. South Korea said the tariffs violate World Trade Organization rules. Samsung and LG are expected to be hit hard by the tariffs. China, the world's largest solar panel producer, called it an overreaction. Luis Cowles heads Asia's economics at the Hong Kong-based Oxford Economics Consultancy. He tells VOA it's been long expected that Mr. Trump would eventually act more aggressively on trade matters as part of his America First campaign.
For quite some time, people had been surprised by how modest the steps were that he took after he got into office. But I think we are now starting to see, you know, some of these steps being taken, and we can expect more of them. But you could see that the share price of Samsung and LG, its competitor, came down today by 4% or something, and that's an indication that these companies are going to be hit by these measures. This arrangement that President Trump took is perfectly legal under U.S. law, but other countries claim that it's not necessarily compatible with WTO law.
Cowles says he is not certain about U.S. claims that dumping of products in this sector was taking place.
There may well be dumping going on at any particular point in time. I'm not sure, though, that that's really the case with washing machines. We were all surprised by how quickly so many companies in China ramped up their production of solar panels, because at some point in China, every province had to have at least one solar panel maker. Many of them are now exporting large numbers of these panels onto world markets.
The United States pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement when Donald Trump took office a year ago. Luis Cowles says these tougher stances don't necessarily signal a trade war, but could result in unintended consequences later.
It's a difficult time because on the one hand, we have wonderful economic growth in the world and we have quite well-doing global trade. But we also have clearly a new wind blowing in the White House, where the administration feels that countries like China have not played by the rules and are kind of taking advantage of other countries and are therefore hurting the integrity of the global system as we know it. There is a case to be made to some extent. The risk, of course, is that once you go down the route of unilateral trade tariffs and unilateral steps, I think it is a slippery slope, and we may well end up with a damaged global trading system, even though that may not have been the intention.
Meanwhile, media reports indicate the 11 remaining members of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Pact without the United States will be signed in a ceremony in Chile in March. TPP will then be known as the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, or CPTPP. Happening now in Asia, authorities in the Philippines have raised the alert level for its most active volcano after it sent a huge cloud of volcanic ash and rocks several kilometers into the air Monday. The Philippine Institute of Volcanology raised its alert level for Mayon to 4 on a scale of 5, signifying hazardous eruption is imminent. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Myanmar's top business leaders have rallied behind State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi's plan for Rakhine State, expanding money and resources on frontline efforts to resettle refugees and rebuild infrastructure. The reparations have been put on hold, and Rohingya community leaders have demanded the restitution of the community, land, legal redress for atrocities, and a path to citizenship be essential as preconditions. The UN Refugee Agency warns it's premature for hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, to return to Myanmar because their safety cannot be guaranteed. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
More than 650,000 Rohingya refugees have fled to Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, since the end of August to escape violence and persecution in Myanmar. The UN Refugee Agency reports refugees from northern Rakhine State continue to arrive in Bangladesh, though at a slower rate. 2 months ago, the governments of Myanmar and Bangladesh agreed on the voluntary return of the refugees to Myanmar. The operation was supposed to have begun Tuesday, but the Bangladeshi authorities reportedly have postponed the repatriation process. As of now, the UNHCR says necessary safeguards for people to return to the homes they fled so recently are absent. Agency spokesman Adrian Edwards tells VOA conditions for voluntary, safe, sustainable returns are not in place.
Anxiety is high in the refugee community in Cox's Bazar, and that presents a risk if not properly managed. Solutions to this crisis ultimately lie in Myanmar. What we need to see in Myanmar is that the guaranteed safeguards that people are expecting are properly in place. At present, they're not.
The UNHCR is calling for unhindered access in Myanmar's northern Rakhine State so it can assess the conditions of return. It says its presence in the area would allow aid workers to help address the legitimate safety concerns for any refugees thinking of going back to the homes they fled. For now, the agency warns against hasty returns, saying the risk of violence breaking out again is too great to ignore. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. A Japanese soldier was killed, several other people injured, as a result of a volcanic eruption near a mountain ski resort. Dozens of skiers were struck by flying rocks caused by the midday eruption of Mount Kusatsu Shiran, including a group of 6 members of Japan's self-defense force on a training mission. You'll see the latest developments at VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, young Chinese not only have more buying power as their economy rapidly expands, but their choice of products is increasingly moving to higher quality items. That, and a South Korean ski resort finding business difficult ahead of the Winter Olympics, are the topics of today's Business Scene with VOA Asia's Skylar Ogden.
China's tech-savvy millennial generation is boosting sales of luxury brands in the country. Once sluggish sales of the like of Gucci handbags and Chanel cosmetics, amongst others, rose at their fastest pace in over half a decade last year, according to the business consulting company Bain & Co. In a recent report, the company said the sale of luxury goods in China hit $22 billion last year, which is up around 20% from the year before. It's the sharpest growth seen since 2011, when luxury sales were being impacted by slow economic growth and a crackdown on corruption. Some analysts say China's government has also been a key driver of that growth. Markets analyst Michael Hewson.
I think we're seeing increased demand from a younger demographic, the 20 to 34-year-old. But I think what's more important, and I think this is what the Chinese government have done, is that they've lowered import taxes on some of the more high-value brands like Burberry, Gucci and Hermes. And that's making these sorts of products that much more affordable.
As for 2018, the report says luxury brands from Hermes to LVMH to Kering are all vying to lure in China's big spending youth, now the driving force in the market. Just about an hour's drive from the Winter Olympics venues in South Korea, an Alps ski resort represents a lost opportunity in the minds of many local villagers. South Korea has spent $800 million on the sporting facilities for next month's Winter Olympics, but in Ulri, it's like a ghost town. Slopes haven't been weeded, buildings are faded and aged, and stacks of concrete and metal lay around without a purpose. Ogum Sheik owns a ski rental shop.
It's completely in ruins now that the ski resort is closed down. All businesses are practically dead. Guest houses and pensions are all in ruins, and of course, no one will come since the ski resort is closed.
In its heyday, Ulri was a bustling resort town. At an altitude of 3,451 feet, the resort has the heaviest natural snowfall and used to draw skiers in from as far as China and Southeast Asia. But its owner went bankrupt in the face of increased competition, and the place has been shut down since 2006. Since then, attempts to reopen the resort have come to naught. Korean investor Alps 7 Resort promised $75 million to renovate the existing slopes and condos and build additional facilities, but it failed to meet the deadline for payment. Local villagers had hoped the Olympic Games would provide enough incentive to lure other investors. Ogum Sheik.
When the Olympics are held, people will want to visit ski resorts. This place is only around an hour away from Yongpyeong, so there could have been a big chance of many people coming here, too.
As the February 9th start date of the Winter Olympics nears and chairlifts still dangle lifelessly from their cables, hope dwindles in the tiny settlement of Ulri. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news alert from VOA Asia. North and South Korea are engaged in a flurry of cross-border visits ahead of next month's Winter Olympics in the South as the bitter rivals press ahead with an agreement for the North to take part in the Games. A delegation from South Korea traveled to the North Tuesday for a three-day visit. Everyone on the Korean Peninsula is invited to visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, while ultrasounds and x-rays help physicians diagnose everything from breast cancer to kidney stones, those scans cannot reveal what is inside the masses. Having that immediate knowledge could help millions of patients avoid unneeded stress and surgery. As Erica Celeste reports, groups at both Purdue and Boston universities are developing technology that will be able to provide that internal view.
Dr. Ji-Shin Cheng has devoted his life's work to something that, until now, has sounded a lot like science fiction. He and his team have developed several medical tools that help diagnose patients using sound and light.
We want to make a device like the tricorder in that Star Trek. So our dream is to make a scientific movie into a real practice.
In the science fiction Star Trek series, the tricorder is waved over a patient to collect information.
Rizzo's alive. Well, your Vulcan metabolism is so low it can hardly be measured.
In conventional medicine, surgeons must either cut out the suspect tissue for analysis or risk exposing already very sick patients to fluorescent dyes and nanoparticles. These so-called labels light up lesions so doctors can study them. Team member Jesse Vang explains their technique, called label-free imaging, eliminates more invasive or toxic procedures by bouncing light off molecules in the tumor.
We do not need labeling. So we can basically look at the vibrations of the molecules, and these vibrations can generate signals in our microscope.
Those vibrations serve as molecular fingerprints unique to each type of molecule. The patterns can be mapped to identify such things as lipids, proteins, and nucleic acid. In essence, the devices give doctors the ability to look at a patient in three instead of two dimensions.
We can see if the patient has a cancer, which usually accumulate a lot of lipids.
The label-free imaging devices have shown promise in identifying kidney, liver, and breast cancer. One device, the Margin PAT, funded by the National Institute of Health, will also help breast cancer surgeons remove tumors more efficiently and accurately. In the United States, about a quarter of all breast cancer patients must undergo a second surgery to remove missed malignant cells. The developers expect Margin PAT will dramatically reduce that number. Chang and his partner, Dr. Pu Wang, founded Vibronix to manufacture the device. Wang says it could revolutionize medicine around the world.
In China, the medical practice is not as good as the Tier 1 hospital. So those surgeons can use the setup to perform the similar surgery or provide the care as exactly the same quality as the first-tier surgeons.
If all goes as planned, the Margin PAT will be on the market within 3 years, and several more of Chang's label-free imaging devices won't be far behind, making his dream for a real Star Trek tricorder one step closer to reality. For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in West Lafayette, Indiana.
The world's biggest consumer electronics show in Las Vegas is over, but this year's battle for consumers and their pocketbooks has only just begun. As smaller companies do not have the resources for research and development, big companies such as Samsung, Canon, and others have a common message for them, along with VOA's George Pudich. Let your imagination tell you how to use our technologies.
While some enjoyed live music and dancing, others were mesmerized by the quality of new large video screens. Samsung's almost 4 meters diagonal TV, called The Wall, comprises microscopically small LEDs that emit their own light, so there's no backlight source. The colors and details are simply stunning. The technology is modular, making it possible to create screens of any size.
A lot of times at CES, the product lineup itself becomes the hero and the centerpiece. But for Samsung, it's the technology that drives these products is the message that we're trying to get out.
Camera giants such as Canon and Nikon came with a similar idea. Make a high-end product and then let others use it.
It is our friends, our companies that are out there that are using the Canon products to power their visions, their concepts, their business to turn what they want.
This inventory-taking robot uses a Canon camera to scan products on shelves. Other robots use Nikon cameras to capture action shots impossible for human photographers.
We're showing a demonstration of just how precise and how fast unmanned robotics are when it comes to motion photography, right?
Talking about robots, this cute robot dog named Aibo also attracted large crowds. First created in early 2000s, Aibo is now much improved, with touch sensors around its head and back. It also responds to voices and reacts to human faces. Humans very easily bond with him, even if they own a real dog.
It's different feeling, you know. Yeah, this is more safe for a child. And I think it's going to be sad if he lost electricity or other, if we don't update it. So, yeah.
For now, Sony plans to sell Aibo only in Japan for the equivalent of $1,800 plus a monthly subscription. But no doubt, it is a rare breed. George Pudich, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We report a lot about technology, and of course, technology brings our program to you in a lot of different ways, like online. You can follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and send us an email at voaasia@voanews.com. But one of the older technologies we're always fond of is the radio. You can hear us on CCU Radio at National Chungcheng University in Taipei, Taiwan. We thank everyone there who was listening today. We also thank our engineer, Zainab Abdel-Rahman, our director, Tracy Carter, Skylar Ogden, David Bird, and Ira Melman on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. Have a great day.